The next matter on calendar is Holdaway Foster versus Brunel, case number 61655. Are counsel ready to proceed? Please do. You filed a reply brief. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much?
4 minutes.
4 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, very well.
May it please the court, counsel, Madam Chief Justice. The case before you is a clear example by the district court refusal to apply the full faith and credit for Child Support Orders Act and the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act.
Chief, I'm having a very hard time hearing.
Oh, okay. Could you speak up? The acoustics are difficult in this courtroom.
Sure. The matter before this court today is a clear example by the district court's refusal to apply the full faith and credit for Child Support Orders Act and the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, and its misapplication of the defensive of latches, waiver, and estoppel. We're here today to ask this court to reverse the district court's decision. The first part of my arguments, I will address the requirements under the Act, the Full Faith and Credit for Child Support Orders Act and UIFSA in modifying child support orders. The second part of my arguments, I will address the retroactive application of the Act. The third part of my arguments, I will discuss the control and order analysis under Section 611.207 of UIFSA and the NRS 130.207. And the last part, I will discuss the defense of latches, waiver, and estoppel raised by the appellee, Robert Brunel. In this case, we have multiple orders. We have a 1985 divorce decree that issued child support in the amount of $200 per month. The same court modified that order in 1985, raised child support to $625 per month. Shortly after, Robert, the appellee in this case, moved to Hawaii and successfully petitioned the court in 1992 to modify the Nevada 1989 order. He then again petitioned the court in 1996 and was successful in having the court reduce the child support further to $200 a month. It should be noted that in 1990, Holdaway submitted the request for the Hawaii court to enforce the Nevada 1989 order, and the court of Hawaii did issue an income withholding in the amount of $625 per month plus $50 in back pay child support.
Counsel, the briefing is fairly silent as to the 92 and the 96 activity and whether or not there was afforded notice and opportunity in the Hawaii proceedings.
It is unclear.
And the fact that no action was ever taken to set aside the 92 or 96 activity, just to glean us on what.
It is unclear as to whether or not Pamela received notice of the hearings in Hawaii. However, the answer to that question is not important because UIFSA doesn't require that. Because UIFSA requires more than notice for the moving party to modify a child support order from another state. So to answer you that question, I don't know whether or not there were notices sent to Pamela, and the answer to that question is not important in this case. She did, however, submit a request to the Clark County District Attorney's Office here to enforce and contest the Hawaii child support order in 1992 and again in 1996.
Why shouldn't her inaction in pursuing this bar her from collecting those arrearages?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Why shouldn't her inaction in pursuing the arrearages bar her? There was a significant period of time that lapsed.
Well, Your Honor, she didn't just sit there and do nothing. She, in 1990, she submitted the petition to be for the child support order for the Nevada child support order to be enforced in Hawaii in 1992. She submitted Title IV again to enforce the child support order in Hawaii. She made multiple requests. She made multiple requests for the Hawaii court to enforce that order. So her conduct in this case does not constitute waiver. In 1994, Congress enacted the Full Faith and Credit for Child Support Orders Act. That act provided the template for the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, which was mandated by Congress in 1996 to be adopted by every single state. Nevada adopted that act in 1997. And that, Nevada enacted UIFSA in 1997, and the same was codified in ARS 130.201. Chapter 130. Under the requirements of UIFSA, there are three elements the moving party must satisfy. And the first one is, in order for him to modify the child support order, he must show that the child, the individual obligee and the obligor, do not reside in the issuing state. The second element is that the moving party is a non-resident of the state seeking a modification. And the third element is the respondent is subject to personal jurisdiction of tribunal of this state. So all three elements must be satisfied in order for the moving party to petition a respondent state to modify an original child support order from the issuing state. In this case, both Pamela and the children never left the state of Nevada. At the time that Robert petitioned his 1992 modification, he was the only person residing in Hawaii. Therefore, the Hawaii court did not have proper subject matter jurisdiction to modify the Nevada 1989 order. In a recent case issued by this court, Vail versus Postal is a 2012 case. In that case, the mother brought a motion to modify a child support order in the state of Nevada, and Nevada was the state that issued the child support order. This court determined that Nevada still has subject matter jurisdiction to enforce the order because no other state has ever entered the order. However, this court determined that because nobody resided in the state of Nevada, not the parties, not the children, therefore Nevada does not have proper subject matter jurisdiction to modify the child support order. Similar to this case, Pamela and children never left the state of Nevada. So when we apply the logic in the Vail case to the facts in this case, the district court in Hawaii did not have proper subject matter jurisdiction to modify the Nevada 1989 order. The only difference between the facts in the Vail case and the facts in this case is that the Nevada 1989 order and the Hawaii 1992 order were issued before the enactment of UIFSA. So it begs the question whether or not the UIFSA and the Full Faith and Credit for Child Support Orders Act apply retroactively. When it comes to this question, this is a case of first impression. We could not find a case on point in Nevada that addresses whether or not this act should apply retroactively. However, other jurisdictions have for many years uniformly held that the act applies retroactively, and the case on point is the Wilson County versus Egbert case. In that case, the court gave three reasons as to why the act should apply retroactively. Number one, the statute was primarily procedure in nature. Number two, the retroactive application of the act does not result in manifest injustice. And number three, a failure to apply the act would frustrate the essential purpose of the act. And that purpose is to avoid having multiple conflicting child support orders. The facts in that case are similar to the facts in this case. Not exactly the same, but pretty similar. In that case, the North Carolina court issued a 1989 child support order in the amount of $520 a month shortly after the father moved to Florida. And he petitioned the Florida courts to modify that child support order, and the Florida did modify that order. Again, in 1997, he petitioned again, and the court entirely dismissed the support obligation. In applying the elements under UIFSA, the Wilson County Court held that because the moving party did not satisfy the requirements under UIFSA, therefore, the modification Florida is invalid. So, to answer this court's second question in its order is whether or not the fact that Pamela might have received notice would apply, would affect the retroactive application of the act. The answer to that question is no. Whether or not Pamela received notice of the hearings in Hawaii would not affect the retroactive application of the act, because none of the decisions cited in my opening brief concerns with notice. The third point I want to address is the control and order analysis. Section 207 of UIPSA and Chapter 130.207 of the Nevada Revised Statute provides the roadmap to determine which order is the controlling order. That statute provides that if only one of the tribunals would have continuing exclusive jurisdiction under this chapter, the order of that tribunal controls and must be recognized. And in this case, Nevada never lost its continuing exclusive jurisdiction. Why? Because both children remain in the state of Nevada. The mother remained in the state of Nevada. The only person left the state was Robert when he moved to Hawaii. So under the control and order analysis, it is obvious that the order issued in Nevada, the 1989 order, is the control and order. I see that my time is up. I just want to make one last point. The defenses raised by the appellee are latches and waiver, and this court have held in Home Savings Bigelow that latches may not be found when the applicable statute of limitation has not run. And NRS 125B.050, enacted in 1987, provided that if a court has issued an order for the support of a child, there is no statute of limitation in which an action may be commenced. So obviously, that just does not apply to this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nguyen, I have a question, if I may, Chief.
Yes, sure.
let's assume that the Nevada court order is the controlling order, as you have argued, and that this court treats USA retroactively. Would Robert have the right to assert the equitable defense of estoppel or waiver to an action to enforce Nevada's controlling order 16 years after the fact?
He has the right to raise that defense, but in order for that defense to be successfully raised, he must show that Pamela intentionally relinquish her right to collect child support, and her conduct by requesting for relief through the district attorney's office here is inconsistent with the appellee's assumption that she waived her rights.
But what I'd like you to argue or discuss is why the district court abused its discretion in determining that Pamela's acquiescence in the Hawaii orders and no appeal from those orders can also be construed as an equitable estoppel or a waiver of her right to pursue a more timely payment of the child support arrearages.
To answer that question, we have to look at the elements required in Parkinson and McKella, and we have to look at the conduct of the person enforcing child support to determine whether or not her action constituted an acquiescence, waiver, or estoppel. In this case, it is very clear that by actively contesting the order, by utilizing the service of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here, she did not acquiesce or waive her rights. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, it seems that the district court concluded that her acquiescence in the Hawaii orders, even if they were unenforceable or invalid and no appeal taken from them, operated as an acquiescence. How did the district court abuse its discretion in arriving at that conclusion?
The district court failed to take into consideration the letter that Pamela received back in 1992 from the Hawaii Transport Enforcement Agency. In that letter, the Hawaii Enforcement Agency stated very clear that the Hawaii orders do not supersede the Nevada order. Therefore, Pamela continues to have remedy for collection of tax intercepts. So she was in good faith relying upon the letter from the Hawaii.
Was that the same order or the same letter that directed her to pursue arrearages in Nevada?
And so the same letter?
Was that the same letter that directed her to pursue arrearages in Nevada? That was about 1992, I think.
I don't think that's the same letter. That she was recommended by the Clark County District Attorney's here to bring an action because once arrearages have been accumulated, it's no longer in their authority to bring an action on her behalf. So mm-hmm. She has to retain private counsel to bring an action on her behalf, and that's what she did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you've exhausted your rebuttal time.
Sorry?
You exhausted your rebuttal time.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, Joseph Houston, for the respondent, Mr. Brunel. I would like to just go right to the questions, because I think those are very important, that were asked in the order. The first was whether or not Pamela received notice of the child support determinations in Hawaii, and obviously the answer to that is yes, because the Hawaii order was in April of 1992.
Counsel, is that part of our record, though, that was brought before the district court? Was that litigated down below or at least gone into? Or is this just your...
This was part of the record in the... this was in their motion. In their original motion filed was the letters which proved that she knew. And in the original...
So even though she knew, we come back to this issue of the only party ever in Hawaii was Robert. The children and the mother, at least has been alleged, were never there.
Right.
And so establishing jurisdiction, but then moving a step down... Is Nevada required to give that jurisdiction full faith and credit, or is there a line in the sand where, to a certain point, yes, and then after the ERISA change on the federal level, no?
And I'll respond to that. And if I can just get to it, and just a couple preface things. First, like I say, she undoubtedly received the notice of the 1992 original order reduced, setting it at 350, because in June 1992 she wrote a letter, which is at page 51 of the record, complaining not about the reduction in arrears. She never in any of the documents complained about the reduction of the current child support. She only complained that Hawaii found she paid $15,000 in payments to her, which she said she didn't get. She never once complained about the reduction in child support because she knew he'd lost his income. And this goes along with what Judge Hardesty said. She knew his income had lowered, so she never complained in any of her letters about the reduction in child support. In 1996, when it was reduced further because now he lost his employment completely, she was sent a copy of that order, and that's at page 28 of the record. So it's undoubtedly that she got notice of both these orders, and she also noticed the letter from the...
Notice is a two-part situation.
Right.
Notice of the proceedings, not notice just after the proceedings.
And notice in regards to the 1996 order, the 1996 order at page 62 of the record specifically provides that the parties were notice in the order. Now, whether they were or not, I don't know. The order says they were. That's all I can say. The next thing is you asked a question of whether or not Hawaii started a new order or did they modify the Nevada order. And I would submit they established a new order. For one thing, we don't have in the record anywhere the petition that was filed in Hawaii. Council wants to say it was only to enforce the Nevada order, but that's not what the Hawaii order says, what they were there for. The Hawaii order has four reasons. There's four reasons in the record that at least show she requested them to establish a new order, not to just follow the Nevada order. On page 35 of the record, the order from the first 1992 order specifically states that current child support is established. So why thought they were establishing a current order? Because the state is allowed to establish an order. If there had been no Nevada order, there certainly she could have gone to the DA's office and they could have gone to Hawaii to establish an order. The Hawaii order does say it was established. The findings of fact, which is at page 44 of the record, say that Pamela Backburn filed a uniform support petition requesting entry of an order for support. That's what the body says they did.
That is not an independent order, Mr. Houston. That is asking for enforcement based upon the law.
Our counsel's arguing, but we don't have a petition in front of us to know if that's really true or not. The only thing they're submitting to say that's what the document they're submitting to say that's what she did is a document that was found in the record on page, I don't have the page number, but it was a document found in the record of her signature to the DA a year and a half after the first Hawaii petition. So the only thing we have in the record which supports his argument is a document she signed a year and a half later. The other thing that's important is in the show that Hawaii thought they were doing an initial order and using their law and that was valid is because at page 74 of the record, Hawaii writes a letter to the district attorney's office saying that the oldest child is turning 18 and she's allowed to continue support to 23 if they're still in school. Well, that's not Nevada law. Nevada law, it's 18 if you're out of high, if you've finished high school. If not, it's finished high school at 19. So Hawaii believed they had established an order, and they were going to give child support continued to 23 if requested. Now getting to your specific point. Council says that in 1994, the statute, which we're questioning the use of, the federal statute, was enacted. But these hearings occurred in 1992. And counsel at page 9 of the record in his original motion says, and he's referring to the 1992 order, here the Hawaii child support order was issued before the enactment of the FFCC-SOA and thus presumed to be valid. As such, there were two valid orders which existed in 1992. They're agreeing to that. There were two valid orders. And so then if you apply the statute now, and we apply it now, we're not applying it in 1992 and 1996 and 1997. We're applying it in 2012 when she requested relief.
Let me add something to what you just said. You said there were two valid orders. If I accept your position as to Hawaii being two valid orders, we still have a valid order in the state of Nevada.
That's correct.
Has not been set aside. Now we have three valid orders. Now, what do we do?
No, there are two. We have Hawaii and that. And the statute tells us what to do. It's just being misargued by counsel. And the statute, which is 28 U.S.C. 1738B in subsection F, it recognized that there could be problems like this, that there could be two orders in two valid orders in two states. So in section F, it addresses what to do. The new state, when it's raised, not when it's original, we don't look back, when it's raised, what do we do? And it's raised in 2012. And it says, if one or more child support orders have been issued with regard to an obligator and a child, which is the truth, if we're accepting that there are two, a court shall apply the following rules determining which order to recognize. And the only one that applies is subsection 3. If two or more courts have issued child support orders for the same obligator and child, which it is, and one More than one of those courts would have continuing exclusive jurisdiction under the section. So you have to look at whether both states still have continuing exclusive jurisdiction. If they do, then you go to the third part. And you do, in this case, because in Section D, it defines what continuing exclusive jurisdiction is. Continuing exclusive jurisdiction is, number one, the current, not the previous, the current home state of the child. There is no current home state of the child because we don't have a child anymore. So we don't have a current home state of the child, so we have to go to the next section. And the next section says if the order was in the residence of any individual contestant, and that contestant still lives in that residence, and that's both of them. My client still lives in Hawaii. She still lives in Nevada. We still have two orders. So then it goes on in subsection F3 to tell you what to do if that's the case. So if the order has not been issued in current home state of the child, which is correct, and they both have continuing jurisdiction, because now the only issue now is where they live, and they both still live in the states that issued the order, then subsection 3 says what you should do. The order most recently issued must be recognized. And the order most recently issued was the Hawaii order. That's the order that has to be recognized. So I believe even under that federal statute, when you apply it in 2012, if you'd applied it when the kids were 16, it would be Nevada. But if you apply it in 2012, when there are no more minor children, then it's the most recent order. And the last thing is Judge Elliott ruled, besides ruling, she didn't believe she had jurisdiction, it was why, ruled that there were latches, waiver, estoppel, because she received this 20 years beforehand, 20 years before she brought this motion. She knew that my client had lost or reduced his employment significantly because that the information of his income was in the order she received. She didn't take any action. She was told by the DA in 1992 she could take action. She waited till 10 years after the children had emancipated. My client was severely prejudiced because if she would have brought this action in 1992, arguing that they didn't have jurisdiction and Nevada would have agreed, my client would have simply said, okay, I want to have a counter motion to modify my child support because I shouldn't be paying what I'm paying, $625 a month. What I was paying was making substantially more. And so,
Mr. Houston, when she applied latches and estoppel, did she ask if the parties wanted an evidentiary hearing on those issues, or did she just do it based on the record?
I think based upon clearly what had happened. She had waited 20 years. My client, I mean, there's no dispute that my client had lost his income, first lowered and then lost it. And, I mean, she sees these cases every day, and she didn't say this is close or anything. She said, you know, to say this isn't latches or waiver is ridiculous. That was her comment.
Is there any problem getting around 125B0503A in the sense that it does away with the statute of limitations?
I don't believe so, because then if his argument about the statute, because the statute of limitations is indefinite, you can never have label, latcher, and estoppel. Well, if that's the case, then there wouldn't be the Parkinson case, which the Supreme Court's already said is a valid case. You would have to say, okay, we're overruling those cases. So no matter how long you wait or why you wait, it doesn't matter anymore. You can always get child support. And like in Parkinson, it was only a wait of 5 years. The children were going to emancipate in 5 years. And so he didn't, in Parkinson, the man stopped paying support because he wasn't getting visitation. So she waited until after the kids emancipated so he wouldn't get any visitation, says, now I want my back child support. Of course, he can't say, well, I want my back 5 years back, and the court couldn't give that to him. So the court said, no, you waited, it's latches, it's a stop, I'm doing it. We got way more than that here, and there's significant prejudice because under 125B140, the court couldn't have a hearing today and say, okay, well, what was your child support should have been back then, because once a month goes by, you can't modify child support by the legislature. And so there's no way the court, even if it wanted to, could take into consideration the reduction in my client's income for all those years. I don't have anything else unless you have any questions.
Does anyone have any further questions? Very well, thank you.
Thank you.
This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court.